space stations, aliens, and psychic powers. Prey 2017 has it all, including a vast swath of lore dispersed throughout the game, ranging from the not-so-distant space race of the 1960s to the not-so-distant future of 2035. If you've ever been curious about the complete lore of the game, then this episode is for you. Hey there, welcome to the Lore to Death podcast, a deep dive into the lore of your favorite games, movies, shows, and more. My name is Brett, and today I wanted to talk about one of my favorite games of all time, 2017's Prey, made by Arkane Studios, the same people who made the Dishonored games. Surprisingly, this game has no relation to 2006's Prey, or its sequel, which has the same name, and interestingly enough, it seems like the title was actually forced upon Arkane Studio when they would have preferred to name it something like Typhon or Starseed. But enough about the semantics, I'm not going to bore you with the strange happenings of video game studios. What I wanted to talk about today is the entire lore of this game. I wanted to go through the timeline of events in the game to figure out how the Talos 1 space station came to be, how it became infested with a hostile alien life form, and what was the goal of the station. Before we get started, I just want to ask that you rate this podcast 5 stars wherever you're listening to it, or like and subscribe if you're on YouTube. The only way that I know that you're enjoying the content that I'm making is if you let me know. So rate the show, leave a comment, or send an email to lordtodeath@gmail.com to suggest an episode or just to say hi. So with that out of the way, let's get on with the episode. Prey takes place in the year 2035 aboard the Talos 1 space station, where we follow the protagonist, Morgan Yu, and their brother, Alex Yu, as they wrestle with the fact that the Transtar station has been overtaken by a hostile alien life form known as the Typhon. I know that was a little bit of an info dump, but these are all of the keywords that we're going to focus on. The Yu family, who work for the company Transtar, which owns the Talos 1 space station, which just happens to be infested with the Typhon. And you might be thinking, Brett, you just explained 60% of the plot of the game. What's going on? And to that, I would say there is a lot going on in the game, and I merely wanted to set the stage for the information overload that is about to happen. But to understand why there's a space station that's been overrun by aliens in the year 2035, we're going to have to go back in time about 80 years to the infamous space race that led humans into venturing into outer space for the first time. In the year 1955, we had the space race in which the United States and the Soviet Union were both eager to one-up each other and be the first to launch an object into space. In this year, they both made announcements to the public that this was their intention and they wanted to get a satellite into orbit around the Earth. And it was 2 short years later, in 1957, that the Soviet Union won the initial space race and were able to launch a beach ball-sized satellite named Sputnik 1 into orbit. The next year, in 1958, the United States managed to successfully launch their own satellite into orbit, which was called the Explorer 1. So, at this point, both nations had successfully launched an object into space, and that would mean that the space race is over, no? Absolutely not. Later in the same year, the Soviet Union secretly launched another object, a deep space probe called Verona 1, which, fun fact, means crow in Russian, to let themselves know that their first launch wasn't a fluke and that they were still in first place. The Verona 1 settled into a secure orbit around the Earth-Moon Lagrange point 2 and began transmitting deep space telemetry back to the Soviet Union on Earth. Now, hold up just a dang minute. What is the Earth-Moon Lagrange point 2? And I'm so glad that you asked this question, because this episode's script was delayed by an entire day because I couldn't just leave this term alone and I had to research everything there was to know about it. I don't want to get too into it because, like with any physics equation, there's a lot of information there and I'm more of a history teacher, not a science teacher. So for the sake of understanding where the Verona 1 was sitting in space, here's the broad strokes. The Lagrange points are points of equilibrium for small mass objects under the gravitational influence of 2 massive orbiting bodies, of which there are 5 points, which are typically notated as L1 to 5. For the Earth-Moon-Sun system, the Sun is treated as a fixed object, and the Earth-Moon system is treated as a 2-body system that is orbiting the Sun. Between these three celestial bodies, there are 5 points, known as the Lagrange points, where a gravitational equilibrium can be maintained. So, long story short, if an object is placed at any of these Lagrange points, it would effectively stay fixed in place on that point because of the opposing gravitational fields from all three bodies. I would urge you to look up a reference photo for this because it's actually really, really interesting, or at least it is to me, and these next couple of sentences aren't going to make too much sense if you don't have a reference open. But basically, points 4 and 5 are effectively the most stable points, and they sit on either side of the moon at about a 40-degree angle from the Earth's orbit from the moon. However, points 1, 2, and 3 are the least stable options, being on the opposite side of the moon, between the Earth and the moon, and on the other side of the Earth in line with the celestial bodies. There's one article that I really liked that states that the equilibrium on these points is similar to trying to balance a pencil on its point, and that while it's theoretically possible, any small perturbing influence would cause the object on that point to be driven out of equilibrium. But these points are still useful for a small spacecraft that can maintain an orbit around these points without expending too much energy, a la the Verona 1. So the Verona 1 spacecraft is in orbit around the Earth-Moon Lagrange point 2, which, if you're following along in your textbook, is the point that is on the opposite side of the moon from Earth. That was a lot of research and a lot of effort for the simple sake of saying that this spacecraft is hiding on the other side of the moon, and it's telling the Soviets deep space secrets. Now, if there are any physics nerds listening to this episode, I know that this isn't the full story of the Lagrange points, and there are plenty of other things that come into play when talking about them, and I'm sure I got something maybe a little bit wrong, but after some careful consideration and plenty of rewrites, this is the best way that I could find to attempt to describe them in a couple of short minutes, so please don't be angry at me for my layman's explanations of physics. In 1960, 2 years after the launch of the Verona 1 spacecraft, there was a sudden total communications failure. The Soviets couldn't talk to their spacecraft about the deep, dark secrets of space, and they couldn't cope with the idea of being ghosted by their own creation, so they sent out a team of cosmonauts to investigate the disturbance. When the team arrived at the spacecraft, however, they were not prepared to deal with the cause of the disturbance. What they found was an alien life form, a shimmering gray-black substance that seemed to display the characteristics of solids, liquids, and gases all at once. It was truly an anomaly, and they could seemingly change shape at will and use their appendages as weapons. And so they did, and they were extremely hostile, so all members of the mission were lost, and footage of the event was classified as a state secret by the Soviets. This was probably why Yuri Gagarin was noted as the first man in space rather than this team of cosmonauts, because no one was supposed to know that they were up there in the first place. And of course, the need to cover up the story was a necessity. The Verona 1 remained at the Lagrange Point 2, still infested with the alien life forms, which we would later come to know as the Typhon. This could not be kept a secret forever, though, and 2 years later, in 1962, the Soviets were forced to ask the Americans for help in containing the threat. President John F. Kennedy and Soviet Premier Khrushchev publicly agreed to terms, and the two nations announced that they were going to make a joint agreement and go to the moon together. This initiative was called the Kletka program, Kletka meaning cage in Russian, although it seems like in-game it's noted as meaning cell, which is probably just a weird translation referring more to a prison cell than anything else, but I just thought that translation was kind of interesting. The idea of the Kletka program was to build a permanent installation to contain and study the Typhon, and it would be launched in 1963. It was a small space station which contained a laboratory so that they could experiment and see if they could harness the power of these organisms. However, this mutual agreement would not last for long, as is typically the case for American-Russian relations. Later in 1963, the Soviets would rally an attempt to assassinate JFK, which would bring a very swift end to any relationship between the Americans and the Soviets. And the Americans wrestled control of the Kletka space station from the Soviets and launched their own initiative, which they dubbed Project Axiom. Project Axiom had the same goals as Project Kletka, in essence. But now the US had full control over the project, which meant that they could get as weird with it as they wanted to. The main goal of the project was to generate new technology based on researching the Typhon organisms. And you might be wondering what kind of technology can possibly be made from studying aliens. And I think to understand that, we'll need to take a brief break from our history lesson and dive into what makes the Typhon worth researching and not eradicating. Like I mentioned before, the Typhon were composed of a shimmering gray-black substance that was able to mimic solid, liquid, and gaseous forms. This meant that they could change the viscosity and shape of their form, making them very versatile and unpredictable. You might think that being squishy, or at the very least malleable, would make them weaker, but it's actually quite the opposite. They were extremely highly durable, and even the weakest of them took quite a bit of force to take down. I think this was due in part to the fact that they were able to change their shape. If they were able to change the solidity of a part of their body at the time of impact from something like an attack, I would imagine that it would absorb the impact of the weapon and therefore reduce the damage done to their body, if you can even call it a body. However, we don't know what it is exactly that makes them able to change their shape at will, and there's not really much explained about their anatomy or their genetic makeup, so they remain somewhat of an anomaly. We just know that whatever they are, whatever they're made of, is extremely durable. And because they could change their shape, there were plenty of different classifications of Typhon ranging from small to large depending on what shape they took. The smallest of them is probably the cystoid, which is basically just a circular mass that acted as a floating mine that could sense movement and home in on a target to explode. The next largest would be a mimic, which earns its name by being able to change shape to mimic that of any inanimate object. This is a really interesting form because it means that not only can they change their shape, but they can actually physically disguise themselves and change their outer appearance to match the materials of a nearby object. This could be anything from a coffee mug to a desk and pretty much anything else that can fit in an office. The purpose of this was likely a defense mechanism. Being able to change their form at will to blend in with their environments would slow down enemy attacks and give way for sneak attacks from their end. Very tricky fellows the mimics are, and there are four different substates of mimics, which were greater mimics, which were just a larger, more dangerous version of a mimic. And then there are ethereal, thermal, and voltaic mimics, which were just mimics that were infused with different elements. Then you start getting into larger Typhon like the Phantoms, which were humanoid in shape because another kind of Typhon, the Weavers, are able to reanimate the corpses of humans in order to create them. Phantoms, while being the size of a human, were incredibly agile and strong, which made them a very fearsome foe. And the fact that there was at least one Phantom for every human killed meant that the more people who died on the station or the battlefield, the stronger the Typhon got because there were more of them. Phantoms also come in the same elemental varieties that mimics can assume, and also have the ability to teleport by phase shifting. Now, this isn't true teleportation as they can't just disappear somewhere and reappear in another place, but it's more like they're able to rearrange their cells and almost throw them at another location to very quickly move over short distances. The Weavers, like I mentioned, were kind of just a variety of the mimics. Some of them seemed to be just randomly selected to transform into a Weaver, which was just a giant floating mass of tentacles. And they stayed floating even in areas where there was gravity. This is likely because they were using some sort of telekinetic power or psychic ability to keep themselves afloat. They are called Weavers because they weaved what was known as coral, which was a luminescent yellow substance that held a neural network that the Typhon used to communicate with each other, and it was able to hold the neurological functions of those who were killed by the Typhon. Weavers, along with being able to create phantoms from dead bodies, were also able to create other variety of Typhon like the cystoids, nightmares, poltergeists, and technopaths to defend themselves. We'll start with the technopaths, which are easily described as a Typhon organism that took over a machine like a robot, such as an operator or a turret. Turrets would be self-explanatory. An operator, on the other hand, was a floating robot that had many different capabilities depending on its designation. So it could be a floating medic that went around and healed people. It could just be an AI that was there to just generally help. But it's important to note that operators are just floating robots that are around the space station. At least much later in time when the game is taking place. Poltergeists are created out of a Weaver's attempt to make a phantom that failed for one reason or another. Poltergeists are given their name because they can disguise themselves in plain sight, sort of like the mimics, except they just disappear instead of turning into another object, and they can use telekinetic powers to hurl objects towards their foes. So, again, similar to the Mimics, they're very much ambush predators. Nightmares are the largest and strongest Typhon by far, aside from the Apex. They are sort of like an advanced version of Phantoms, but I cannot overstate how large they are. Fighting them is almost impossible, even for a seasoned fighter, and the preferable option to dealing with a nightmare is to simply evade it until it loses interest and fades away. Their purpose seems to be to deal with aberrant Typhon who don't share the hive mind, but the exact reason why they exist is kind of unclear to me beyond that. They're basically just a giant killing force. And then finally, I just mentioned that there is the Apex. This seems to be the final form of Typhon, and it's born of the coral that is spread around by weavers. It seems like if enough coral was created, or perhaps if there was enough neural information stored within the coral, that an Apex can be summoned to essentially consume everything within the vicinity. Now, with all that being said, I'm sure there are plenty of questions. I know this episode has been kind of disjointed so far, but I promise it all comes together. Namely, how can I just gloss over the fact that I said that they basically all have psychic powers? And that right there is the answer to why the scientists seem so interested in researching them rather than just getting rid of them. I'm sure that if they wanted to, they could have just blown up the Verona 1 and been done with the Typhon from second contact, but the fact that they exhibit powers that are literally out of this world is too intriguing to let go. And so, to answer this very, very long-winded question, they wanted to study the Typhon so they could break down their neural patterns and implement them into technology so that humans could harness their psychic powers, whether that was phase shifting or telekinesis or somehow being able to change your form like the Mimics could. And so the United States expanded upon the Kletka program with Project Axiom by expanding the space station to create a supply hub on the moon to provide raw materials, storage, and support to the primary research space station. So you have Kletka, which is the research station, and Axiom, which is the moon base. And while the initial space program was born out of a Soviet-American truce and it was built up very quickly, the scale of this project took a considerable amount of time. Over the next 14 years, they would work up on building up the station and the moon base, and were heavily invested in studying the Typhon, while keeping its true nature a secret from the general public and even plenty of the staff aboard the station, with plenty of the going-ons being on a very need-to-know basis. During this time when they were building up the station, the first weaver was seen on the space station in 1965, before primary construction of the research station was completed about over a decade later in 1978. 2 years after that, in 1980, there was an incident aboard the research platform, which led to a containment breach and subsequent outbreak known as the Pobag incident that led to the death of a research team. And so, over the next few years, with the danger of this project growing every day with the recent deaths and a lack of concrete results coming from their research, Project Axiom would be shut down in 1984, 20 years after it started. A tertiary reasoning as to why the project was shut down is that there was a lack of funding from budget cuts in the space program under the Reagan administration, and I'm sure that was a large contributor as well. All staff were recalled from their posts both on the research station and the moon base and brought back home, and the station was closed. But a mere 10 years later, the government hold on Project Axiom was lifted, and the research station started to see some activity after a decade of being left floating in space. However, it doesn't really seem like anything notable happened for the next 30 years or so. That may be because of the classified nature of the station, and there just wasn't much information coming out of the station, or perhaps there just weren't any major breakthroughs during this period. I'm not exactly sure which side it falls under, but we're going to make a huge time jump into the year 2025. Enter Transtar Industries, a powerful and influential company that is central to the events of Prey. While there isn't much history surrounding Transtar and where they got their footing exactly, it seems to just be a conglomerate of wealthy individuals who created a company with near unlimited funding to operate in various sectors like aerospace technology, biotechnology, and military technology. This company was founded in the year 2025, and in that same year they made a bid to privatize the Kletka station and its neighboring moon base. There was another company who was trying to do this around the same time, and they were called Chasmacor. And much to Chasmacor's chagrin, Transtar won the bid and aimed to modernize the stations. They decided to start renaming everything and dubbed the moon base Pytheas and gave it a much needed tune-up so that it was up to the task of completely redesigning and upgrading the Kletka station, which they renamed to Talos 1. A member of the Yu family, the seniors of which were on the board of directors and the only public faces of Transtar, Alex is appointed as CEO of Transtar aboard the Talos 1 space station. And it's at this point that I just wanted to pause and kind of gather our footing here a little bit, because it's all new information from here on out. Well, it might have been new information to you, but you know what I mean. It's in the future now. Way back in my preamble, at the beginning of the episode, I mentioned the Yu family, Transtar, Talos 1, and the Typhon. And now we've been introduced to all of them with some much-needed context. Right now, we know that the Typhon are a hostile alien life form that have psychic and shape-changing capabilities that were found aboard the spacefaring vessel in the 1960s. Since then, the Soviets and Americans have been trying to engineer a way to capitalize on those abilities by harnessing the Typhon's neural pathways into what are going to be known as neuromods to transfer those abilities over to humans. 65 years later, after the program had shifted hands, and it had been both shut down and booted back up, the research station built around the moon was bought out and privatized by a conglomerate known as Transtar. Transtar's board of directors was a collective of the world's wealthiest people, and they had a vested interest in the research station in the depths of space, where they could fund projects that might not get the green light on Earth. Among those investors were the parents of the Yu family, William and Catherine, who supplanted their children and relatives into positions of authority within Transtar. William Yu was a neuroscientist and his wife Catherine was a businesswoman, so it makes sense that they would have a vested interest in the neuromods that were being created from the Typhon. Although, I just want to say, I don't know if neuromods were being created before Transtar got involved or if it was just after, but I can't see a reason why they would have had this research going on for like 60 years if they didn't have something specifically in mind. So I would imagine that the idea of neuromods were there before Transtar came in, but I don't really know that. I'm making an assumption because there's not really a whole lot of information as to what the American government would have been doing up on the Kletka station otherwise. The children of the Yu family, Alex and Morgan, were respectively the CEO and director of research on the Talos 1 station, while their cousin, Riley, was the chief administrator of the Pytheas moonbase. And now that we're all caught back up with that summary, let's move on. Over the next several years after the acquisition of the Kletka station, Transtar modernized it into the state-of-the-art research station that we know it as in Prey. To the public eye, it was just a corporate center and general research laboratory for various military and aerotech applications, but the goal all along, as I mentioned before, was to continue the neuromod research and, quote, redefine what it means to be human, end quote. A quick point of order here, I'm not really sure how Transtar knew about the Typhon and the previous research into neuromods if it existed before them. I did mention that the board of directors at Transtar were some of the wealthiest people on Earth, which in itself is kind of an answer, but not a great one. The world's wealthiest people would surely have good connections in the government and just about every sector that you can think of, so at the very least, someone had some insider information, potentially even William Yu, who was a neuroscientist himself, if the neuromods were happening before Transtar got involved. The point I'm trying to make is that it's just very convenient that Transtar just happened to be founded and then buy the Kletka station in the same year, which was coincidentally just in line with their interests, when, to the public, the station was nothing more than a place for deep space research. I wish that we had a bit more information on this portion, but unfortunately, I'm gonna have to just settle for the answer, the rich see all. And having their main priority being the development of neuromods, which are implants that change a person's neural pathways, you can imagine that testing these neuromods might have come into the territory of unethical testing. And it really did. And Transtar was no stranger to unethical practices for the sake of furthering their goals. In 2029, 4 years after their acquisition of the Kletka station, they started a volunteer program which allowed criminals a second life aboard the Talos 1. And this might not sound like it's all that bad, and rehabilitating criminals from gulags and labor camps could be a good thing, but not when those volunteers are internally referred to as test subjects. There's rarely anything good that comes out of referring to a human being as a test subject, and these tests could be anything from just being implanted with a neuromod to see how it reacts with the human body to simply just being put in a room with a mimic to be sacrificed for the sake of harvesting exotic materials from the Typhon afterwards. Exotic materials that were harvested from the Typhon were essential to creating neuromods, and when a mimic attacked a human body, it tended to multiply. So, if you put one mimic and one human in a room, the mimic kills the human, multiplies into four or five other mimics, and then suddenly you have four or five times the exotic material that you did before, which meant that you could just infinitely scale that and make infinite neuromods. Transtar was able to get away with this for several reasons. One is that the volunteers that were sent into space were sent there for rehabilitation through science. That just sounds nice on paper. Two, those volunteers were mostly Russian criminals from gulags, and they had already been forgotten by most of the world and probably assumed dead or worse by any loved ones. So no one was looking for them and no one cared if they died in deep space. And three, the station is just on the other side of the moon where literally no one else can hear you scream. Have you been out there? It's very quiet. So it's all just awful stuff on Transtar's part. In the year 2030, the construction of Talos 1 was officially completed, and I'm genuinely impressed that they managed to acquire the station and basically rebuild it from the ground up into a modern facility in just 5 short years. But because the station was finished, operations on Pythias, the moon base, were dramatically scaled back because they just weren't really needed for much else other than being a resupply point. But they did end up turning Pythias into its own research station on the moon. It was also in this year that the first neuromod was officially created and was available for implementation. I wish that I knew which neuromod it was that was first created, but it hardly matters, I just want to know. I really want to know if it was a Typhon ability or if it was one of the ones that was just created from a human. And see, neuromods weren't just for psychic abilities, even though I know I've been focusing pretty hard on that point, but they were also just generally for learning and enhancing human abilities. One such example could be taking the neural patterns of a world-class pianist and mapping them to a neuromod. Then the person who implants that neuromod would have all of the neural pathways of that pianist and would be able to play at a professional level even if they had never touched a piano. On top of getting psychic powers, I think that this was the real, more practical use of neuromods, and I think this is what Transtar meant by redefining what it means to be human. But also getting telekinesis was kind of a cherry on top. And so it was around this time that Morgan Yu was appointed as director of research aboard the Talos 1. And Riley Yu was becoming the director of Pythias, which was being converted into a secondary research facility. In the March of 2032, Morgan Yu set out from their apartment in San Francisco to accept their position among the stars. After accepting their position and being on Talos 1, Morgan went on to be instrumental in the invention of a number of things, including the psychoscope, which was a device that could basically map the Typhon's neural patterns, upload them into a cloud, and have them ready for use with the neuromods. And I'm guessing it's because of their help in creating the psychoscope that they accepted to be a test patient for their Typhon-based neuromods. And, I mean, who doesn't want telekinesis? I mean, come on. But there were a couple huge problems in being a test subject for neuromods, though, and there was one in particular that Morgan was well aware of, despite accepting to be a test subject. This was the fact that they would have to be constantly adding and removing various neuromods during these experiments, and it was in the removal of neuromods where the issue lay. When a neuromod is removed, the person's memory was reset up to the point when they had that neuromod installed, meaning that if they had a neuromod installed and a month later they wanted to get it removed, their memory would reset back to 1 month to when they had that neuromod installed. So you can see why this was dangerous and why it meant so much that Morgan was essentially willing to give up their life for the sake of testing neuromods, because it meant that they would lose a lot of time and a lot of memories. There was also one other side effect that wasn't very well documented at the time, and that was the personality shift that was associated with having their memory reset so often. Eventually, the patient's personality would start to drift and they would become less and less like themselves. Morgan started getting erratic over time, which resulted in being mentally unstable and prone to fits of violent outbursts, on top of having drastic changes to their own personality, to the point where their values and opinions that they held no longer seemed to matter to them, and they became almost entirely a different person. This meant that there had to be special precautions in place when dealing with Morgan, and they needed to be kept in the loop about what their condition was, where they were, what date it was, and what they did in previous experiments that led them to this point, because they had no idea what they were doing, basically. Every time they started, it was basically like the first time that Morgan was being implanted with a Typhon-based neuromod, even though it could have been the 50th time. But here's where things start to get a little muddy, and here's where we need to remember that Morgan did this voluntarily. It is on record that Morgan not only accepted being the test subject for a Typhon-based neuromod of their own will, but it was their idea to begin with. It is very important to understand that this was voluntary, because the following events are all going to paint certain people in a very bad light, but I think it's worth taking everything from Morgan's point of view with a grain of salt. Morgan would wake up every time that they had a neuromod removed in a simulation of their apartment in San Francisco. This was so that they were in a familiar environment where they could relax and wake up as if it was just any other day in their life. They would wake up and receive a call that they were running some tests before heading out on their trip to the Talos 1 station. Assumedly, after these tests, which were designed to be extremely simple, to test for basic cognitive function, they would be briefed on everything that happened when they had their neuromods removed last. So this was all set up in a way that an understandably distressed Morgan was put in an environment where they could be eased into the reality of having large chunks of their memory permanently gone. Initially, this seemed to have worked well, but over time, Morgan's sense of self started to deteriorate. They started to forget their passwords and request things that had already been done months ago, and this was all due to the constant wiping of their memory. And as I mentioned before, it eventually deteriorated into a genuine mental instability. They believed that the work being done in psychotronics, their work, was abhorrent, and that the very idea of neuromods was something very evil. They began to deny their voluntary involvement in testing them and started to think that everyone was against them, including their brother Alex, who they believed was keeping them against their will. And we see this in logs with Dr. Cole, who acted as their counselor. In an attempt to mitigate the effects of this memory loss and the very clear drift in their personality, Morgan initially recorded several logs for their future self to let them know that this was their decision and that any negative thoughts towards the project, like the feeling that this was all involuntary and evil, was just a byproduct of their constant memory wipes. These logs were meant to help in the grounding process and bring Morgan back up to speed, but the longer that this went on, the less Morgan thought that the person in the recordings were themselves. They thought of them as a different person, and genuinely a different person. They would insist that the Morgan on those tapes was not me. And they assumed that this was all a scheme devised by their brother to keep them in a state of constant sedation and memory loss. It got to a point where it seemed like Morgan wasn't allowed to make any major decisions without their brother, Alex, present, because they were no longer in the right state of mind to be making any decisions. After all, the pride and joy of Transtar were the neuromods, and if we're up to Morgan, they would have it all stopped immediately, the work destroyed, and have everyone sent back to Earth. So to this end, Morgan grew increasingly paranoid. And it's hard to blame them. They no longer knew what was real, and they started to have a real identity crisis on their hands. So Morgan started placing contingencies around the station. They created backup plans, stole and planted key cards, created stashes of equipment, and reprogrammed several operators to assist them, which were called October, December, and January. Or at least those are the three that we know of. However, it seems like these operators were created separate from each other, and each of them held a different ideology implanted by Morgan. So none of the operators trusted each other, and they didn't think the other operators were created by the real Morgan. And we see this later on with December and January, who were constantly at odds with one another, acting like one was the hero and one was the villain. And they were the heroes and villains in their own minds. But that's just a testament to Morgan's mental state at the time and how quickly it was deteriorating. Because one version of the operator wanted to do one thing, but then the next one that was created wanted something totally different. And again, here's where things start to get really confusing, as I mentioned before. As to who's in the right and who's in the wrong, Morgan's state of mind was very clearly deteriorating, and they were no longer the person who they thought they were before. They were paranoid, upset, and disoriented, but they did initially agree to this testing. And here's where Alex comes into the story in a not-so-great light. If your family member was this upset about the work that was happening and they didn't want to be a part of it anymore, I think you might be inclined to listen to them and try to figure a way out of that situation so that they could move on from that position and stop having their memory wiped over and over again and just making the situation worse. Instead, Alex chooses to hold Morgan against their will in the simulation. Or, at least that's how it seems. I think a lot of this is up for interpretation, and the fact that we have an unreliable narrator really paints this in a way where Morgan is being abused and Alex is the abuser. And regardless if that's correct or not, you think that Alex continuing to use Morgan to test the neuromods and keeping them in an indefinite simulation to achieve that end, just because Morgan initially agreed to it, is inherently a bad thing. But you could also see it from the point of view of a CEO whose brother is now hellbent on taking down the company that they have been holding up for several years now. Alex realistically couldn't just let Morgan go, because Morgan knew way too much. Sure, Alex could have moved Morgan to a different area of Talos and tried to mitigate damages to both themselves and the rest of the station, but Morgan would have pushed back and caused physical damage to themselves and everyone around them. That much is very clear, and they couldn't just send Morgan back to Earth because they knew about the Typhon and were directly in the know of the secret projects that Transtar had been working on because they had been working on them personally. So it really comes down to what is more important. Keeping everything that was classified on Talos 1 as a secret, as they had been doing for decades, or giving Morgan the free will to make choices that would make them feel at peace. And you really could not have both. So Alex's only real clear choice was to keep Morgan sedated in a constant state of testing and memory wiping. I'm not trying to justify Alex's actions, which were inherently self-serving, but letting Morgan go means revealing the Typhon to the general public, and the knowledge that the public had been lied to about this space station that had been on the other side of the moon since the 60s. It was probably a really tough spot to be in, and I don't think that either choice was the right one. I think that the choices were either to subjugate one person or ruin the company and potentially the entire population of Earth's worldview. You can really think of it as the trolley theory on a massive scale. Unfortunately, it was Morgan against the world, right? But nothing could last forever. The contingencies that Morgan put into place would eventually all come together, and the operator that he created called January sent an email as a wake-up call to Morgan to get them out of the simulation with the goal of destroying the Typhon and Talos 1 along with them. This was after one of Morgan's memory wipes where something pretty odd happened. I mentioned that they would run Morgan through some tests when they brought them out of the simulation room before they told them it was a simulation. During this test, the scientist that was running it, Dr. Bellamy, was attacked by a mimic Typhon who had broken containment and disguised itself as a coffee mug. Morgan was then sedated and their memory was wiped once again, and they woke up the next day to see an email from January, or 6, actually, grabbed a wrench off of a dead maintenance employee in the hallway and broke out of the simulation room into the back rooms where they were able to gain access to the rest of Talos 1, despite Alex's best efforts to keep them contained in the simulation. It was initially reported that Dr. Bellamy was okay, just in a critical state, but we know later that the Typhon attack did kill him. And not only did it kill him, but the Typhon ended up getting access to the rest of the station and were running rampant, killing pretty much all of the staff aboard. Alex was powerless to stop them along with the rest of the station, so when Morgan got out of the simulation, he just observed from a distance. Morgan is then beckoned to their office by January, who says that there's a recording waiting for them that they need to see, and that this would get them all up to speed. This was a self-recording that Morgan made as a contingency to get their future self up to speed on the situation and on January's side, and they are given the rundown on how to destroy the station. The contrarian, December, warns Morgan that they should ignore what January is telling them to do, and that they should make their way to Alex's emergency escape pod and just leave Talos 1. To do this, they would need to secure their access keycard, which Alex had learned of the whereabouts of and took it as a means of forcing Morgan to confront him so he could offer a third option. Morgan would then head to the Neuromod foyer to meet with Alex, where he suggests that instead of destroying the station and all of the work that had been put into it, or simply just getting into an escape pod and heading back to Earth, that there was another option. Create something called the Null Wave device, which would kill all of the Typhon aboard Talos One. And Morgan had to choose between one of three options laid before them. Which is the right one? It's really hard to say for sure. And here's where things get a little dicey, because there's no canon ending. And here is really where the game diverges into being an open story that branches off of the decisions that you make henceforth. I don't know if I would say that I believe any of the answers to be the right answer, but I don't think that any of them are wrong either. The least likely to be the true ending would be taking the escape pod and just copping out of the rest of the game, but even then I don't think it's necessarily a bad ending, it's just one that I think Morgan would probably have been least likely to choose. Regardless of which ending you choose, there are a few things that would happen almost regardless of the choices made. One is that there are a few people who are still alive on the station aside from Morgan and Alex. Four, most notably, are Dr. Igwe, Sarah Salazar, Michaela Ilushin, and Daniel Sho. Morgan can save all four of these people and they can give them further insight into the happenings of Talos One and provide some much-needed help on their journey by giving them materials and items along the way. Secondly is that Transtar learned of the containment breach on Talos One and realized the risk that came of leaving it unattended or, in the worst case scenario, having someone escape and come back to Earth with the knowledge of the Typhon and all of the other criminal activity that was happening on the station. They ended up hiring a cleanup crew who was led by Commander Dahl, who led this crew of private military contractors on a mission to kill anyone on the station and secure what is referred to as every piece of Cobalt clearance level technology and research about Talos One. These orders are given directly from William Yu, who is in so deep that he is seemingly okay with the idea of Dahl murdering his children. You could argue that since his children were so close to the research that was being done, there was a high likelihood that they were already dead anyways, but there's always the chance that both of them were still alive and you just sent a hitman to kill them, which happened to be the case. Thirdly, upon investigating the coral that the weavers are, well, weaving, Morgan learns that the Typhon are using it to build a large neural network to summon something. I kind of spoiled this point before, I suppose, but the goal of the coral was to summon the Apex Typhon, which would destroy and consume everything that it came across. This, of course, is not an ideal scenario, so the two options to deal with the Typhon and potentially save the Earth from an incoming horde of Typhon would be to either use the Null Wave device or blow up the station and kill all the Typhon. Those are the three things that are going to happen pretty much no matter what path Morgan takes. Of course, if they chose to simply jettison themselves back to Earth in an escape pod, then it's entirely possible that I guess none of this happens, but that would also mean that the station is left intact and the Typhon are left with a free pass to commandeer the station for themselves and ride it back to Earth at some point so they can have the feast of a lifetime. And this is all I can really say on the main plot of the game. However, there is a post-credit scene, which is interesting to say the least. Morgan wakes up in a dark, mysterious room seemingly trapped on an operation table, surrounded by Dr. Igwe, Sarah Salazar, Michaela Ilushin, and Danielle Sho, the survivors that I mentioned before, except they're all operators instead of their physical form, assuming that they're actually dead and that these robots have their memories running through them. It's explained that all that Morgan experienced was just a simulation, and yes, that does mean that we get a little bit of Inception action with the simulation inside a simulation from the beginning. But why was it a simulation? Why would they want to simulate the entire station being overrun by Typhon? And the answer was to see if they can exact empathy from a non-empathetic being. It turns out that Morgan was actually a Typhon who was implanted with human neuromods in an attempt to create a hybrid that has all of Morgan's memories, because Earth has already been overrun by the Typhon. The simulation was a very complex reconstruction of Morgan's memories, and everyone in the room ran a Typhon through those simulations to see what they would do given the same knowledge and circumstances that Morgan had. They wanted to see if a Typhon could learn empathy, because in all the time that they had been researching the Typhon, they were extremely aggressive beings that could just not be reasoned with. The Typhon could mimic and potentially even understand human speech through the neural pathways that they created with the coral, and still, not a single Typhon had ever stopped to consider that peace and coexistence was probably an option. They wanted to see if a Typhon was capable of empathy because the learned empathy was something that they could potentially put into a neural network as a means to communicate with the Typhon and potentially stop the onslaught of Earth. And so the decisions that Morgan made through the course of the game determine the ending at this point. If they were able to show empathy and save people and not just kill everyone and go full scorched earth, then Alex takes the Typhon Morgan's hand and they go and see what they can do with this information. If the Typhon did just go full bad guy, then the Typhon is killed and it's just assumed that they start the experiment over again. The same thing happens if Morgan just escapes in the pod, the experiment is deemed a failure and they just start over. As for Morgan, it's believed that they're long dead. We're not really 100% sure. Because the Typhon Morgan went through a complex scenario that was based on Morgan's memories, we can assume that at least one of these options that happened in the game was presented to Morgan, and that's what Morgan did. But which one of these options would Morgan have chosen? I would once again say that I don't think that there's a wrong answer, because none of the options presented really make a whole lot of sense over the others. But I would still say that the escape pod option is probably the least likely. The other endings don't really matter in terms of which was more likely to have happened, but that begs the question of how did the Typhon end up getting on Earth? Especially if the other two options presented to the Morgan were to destroy the Typhon or destroy the Typhon and Talos. Both of those options end with the Typhon aboard Talos One dying, so how did they manage to get all the way to Earth? And we never really got back around to Pytheas, the moon base, to find out what happened there after they finished construction on Talos 1, and the moon base was essentially turned into a research station. But the events of Moon Crash and the fate of Pytheas actually happened the day after the outbreak on Talos 1, on February 23rd, where, just like on the station, the Typhon wiped out most of the employees on the moon base. Riley Yu, who was in charge of the operation at this point, was one of the survivors, and she was concerned about the outbreak and wanted to make sure that someone knew what had happened at the station. So Riley tried to send the base's data inside a vault operator, which was then intercepted by an enemy spy named Peter, who was working for Chasma Corps. And yes, that's the same Chasma Corps that tried to bid for Talos 1 and lost to Transtar and just could apparently not let go of a grudge from all those years ago. And they were committing acts of espionage on Transtar in some sort of effort to bring them down. Peter was in a satellite that was spying on Pytheas, and his mission was to retrieve the data that Riley had sent out in an operator. But to get to that data, he had to go through a simulation that was a recreation of the moonbase's last moments. However, once he had finished the job, Chasma decided that they didn't need him anymore and double-crossed him, leaving Peter stranded in the satellite that he was spying from. So he managed to crash land onto Pytheas and take control of the emergency shuttle, which made its way back to Earth. And he was entirely unaware of the fact that he had brought a mimic back with him for the ride. Very alien in nature. And that's the official story of how the Typhon got to Earth, through a single mimic that hitchhiked on the back of a spy. I think that the Typhon getting to Earth was pretty much an inevitability, and they didn't really need a direct way there necessarily, just like they didn't need a direct way to get aboard the satellite that was in the moon's orbit. It just seems like the Typhon drift through space aimlessly and latch onto whatever they manage to come across. I don't think that they have any specific goals or malice attached to them. I just don't think that they really fully understand what it is that they're doing. It seems like they just kind of happen upon planets with life on them, multiply in a surprise attack, and then continue to feed until eventually a coral network is built and an apex can finish the job, and then they just move on to the next wherever that might lead them. It's not like they specifically chose the moon or specifically wanted to get to Earth, they just kind of happened upon it. And I'm not trying to justify the actions of the Typhons by any means. What I'm trying to get at is that I think it's all just one big cosmic coincidence that this all happened, and it all just kind of happened to happen without any particular malice behind their actions. And I think that's what makes the Typhon such a great antagonist, is that they don't have these big grand plans to take over the world for one reason or another. There's no monologues. They just kind of have the ability to and just accidentally achieve those ends because the Soviets put a secret satellite into the moon's orbit. If the Soviets never did that, who's to say that the Typhon would have ever ended up on Earth? Maybe they would have just kept floating on by. And that's all there really is to say about Prey, I think. It's a really great game and one that I feel like was overlooked when it came out. I don't think I would have actually played it if I wasn't already in love with the Dishonored games. But I love pretty much everything that has come out of Arkane Studios, and I'm happy to try pretty much anything that they release. And with that being said, I would urge anyone who didn't play it to pick it up next time it's on sale and give it a whirl. There are a lot of choices to be made in the game and so many different ways to play because the absurd amount of weapons and abilities that you can choose make it so it's just one of those experiences that really does feel different every time you play it, and I would really highly recommend it. And that brings me to my favorite question, which is, what did you think? What do you think the overarching message of the game is? I would say that its nationalist and corporate greed are two very prominent, if not overlooked, themes in the game, because everything that happens is because of someone's ego, whether it be Soviet Russia trying to keep the Typhon a secret, or Transtar committing unethical crimes for the sake of research and money. Or do you think that Alex was actually a bad guy, or do you think he was just doing the best given the circumstances of his position? I think it's a little bit of both, and I think it's really hard to say. Sometimes you have to weigh which is more important, and I think he made a very pragmatic choice, and it's hard to fault him for it, but I still don't agree with the methodology of keeping someone eternally in a state of limbo and memory loss and sedation. It just, that feels cruel. And there's even several employees that you see in email chains that question why Morgan is being kept in these tests indefinitely. So I think that speaks for itself. You can find us online at Lore to Death on your favorite social media apps, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on YouTube, so if you head over there and hit subscribe, I would really appreciate it. If you have any questions or suggestions for topics, please send me a message wherever you can find me, or at loretodeath@gmail.com. If you're using the Spotify app, there's a comment section attached to the episode where you could submit any questions or topics. If you're on YouTube, then you know what to do. Drop a comment. I would love to hear from you. And remember, we're all just aliens created from a cosmic nothingness by sheer coincidence, and we somehow have 99% of the same genetic makeup as a mushroom and about 60% of the same genetic makeup as bananas. So, to that I say, reject humanity and return to fungi. Catch me in the forest, spreading spores and spitting lores. Okay. One was particularly bad. So I will lure you to death in the next one. See ya.